The spring allergy season is upon us. That, along with lingering factors contributing to airborne pollution, it's time to buttress your respiratory health with Breathe Clear from my friends at NT Factor. Breathe Clear with NT Factor combines the benefits of NT Factor's breakthrough lipids formula with powerful bioflavonoids and amino acids. Together, they've been shown to restore energy, repair the damage to cells caused by air pollution, decrease allergic reactions, reduce sinus congestion, and open blood vessels. Breathe Clear with NT Factor is the best formulation available for tackling both allergies and the free radical damage caused by air pollution. For a limited time, buy one bottle of Breathe Clear with NT Factor and get another one absolutely free. That's a $27 savings. Just go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com or call 800-982-9158, 800-982-9158. Take advantage of this buy one, get one free sale and arm yourself with the protective power of Breathe Clear with NT Factor this spring and breathe freely while supporting your body's fight against allergies and free radicals. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. I've been very much looking forward to this podcast because today we get an opportunity to talk to investigative reporter Cheryl Atkison about her new book, Follow the Science. Cheryl Atkison is an investigative reporter, formerly with CBS, PBS, and CNN. She's currently managing editor of the Sunday TV show Full Measure with Cheryl Atkison. She's a New York Times bestselling author. She's in her capacity as a host on CBS and other networks, a recipient of five Emmy Awards and the Edward R. Murrow Award for Investigative Reporting. Her newest book, Follow the Science, will be out September 3rd, but is available anywhere for pre-order. In addition, she's a fifth-degree black belt master, which comes in handy because when you generate controversy like she does with some of her outspoken views, you got to throw elbows a little bit, right?
Okay. Indeed.
Okay. And just by way of background, Cheryl, I've read many of your books, Cheryl, and I was particularly enjoyed the book Slanted, How the News Media Taught Us to Love Censorship and Hate Journalism. Also, you've written a book entitled The Smear, How Shady Political Operatives and Fake News Control What You See, What You Think, and How You Vote, and Stonewalled. And you really had a very, very successful career as a correspondent and anchor. Indeed, you appeared on the evening news, on CBS News, and other venues, PBS, CNN, local news. But you reached kind of an epiphany where you kind of became disenchanted with mainstream news, and your views became increasingly outspoken on such third rail issues as vaccines, and, well, you kind of took a more independent path. So tell us a little bit about your personal journey.
Well, I would say that for most of my career, you know, there's always conflicts in newsrooms of a kind, but I was very successful over time in reporting on scandals and controversies inside government corporations and so on, and was assigned to look into medical-leaning controversies around the 2000 time period at CBS News as an investigative reporter. Didn't know much about them, wasn't terribly interested in medical news, but I liked the medical corruption because this was much like all my other investigations involving many of the same components, whistleblowers, corrupt money influences, cover-ups, the same sort of thing. And I saw that there was so much to uncover once I started to peek under the tent a little bit. And these stories were very much encouraged by CBS News, by the folks who assigned me to do the stories. It led me to learn so much about what was going on, you know, what's going wrong inside our medical industry and our conflicts of interest with government. And then the media got involved in the conflicts of interest. Looking back, I was able to put together some pieces of the puzzle that the media used to be very interested in uncovering these scandals, including New York Times, Washington Post, all the networks. We are all looking at vaccine injuries as it was becoming an increasing topic with the ballooning autism cases in the early 2000s. And everybody was on board with investigating. And then something changed. And while the news division still wanted me to do these stories, and they were branching off into other stories and many more medical-related stories, there was pushback from other parts of the corporation, which were, I guess, were getting pushback from government and corporate interests in ways I didn't see. They were invisible to me at the time. But it coincided with the, I'll call it the deal with the devil. The media, we at CBS News and the corporate level, our lobbyists partnered with pharmaceutical lobbyists to lobby on Capitol Hill to get direct-to-consumer advertising for prescription drugs allowed. Maybe some of your audience doesn't remember a time when you couldn't advertise prescription drugs on TV. It's historically a relatively new development. And once that happened, the billions that now support news media, we can now see influences what we do and don't report. And all of a sudden, you know, many of our most important topics and health and medical scandals almost fell off the earth as far as the news media was concerned, except to the extent that the media serves to either discredit the questions or defend the pharmaceutical industry. And this was true not just with that topic. There were other topics maybe of less interest to your audience that were also being controlled in ways that made me feel as though around the 2012 to 2014 time period, although, yes, I still did a lot of reporting that received, for example, Emmy nominations and recognition and some important investigations, a lot of it, I would say more of it, was being left, shall we say, on the cutting room floor.
Mm-hmm.
And what did get on, or what they wanted, certain conflicted producers, was not an honest reflection of the facts on the ground. So I broke my contract with CBS mid-contract and left, and now I'm reporting independently on Full Measure with Cheryl Atkinson. Can't believe we're going to be starting our 10th year in the fall. But I have had some good success with continuing to do good, solid, independent reporting in that venue, which most people in the media, in the news media, can't do today.
Well, so let's harken back to that decision. You know, it was in 1997, you know, kind of recent history, that they began to allow drug ads on TV, direct-to-consumer or DTC ads. And for many of us, it actually is kind of surprising to recognize that this is a recent thing, because we're so inundated with drug ads on TV, especially in the shows where the demographics tend to skew older, right? You know, so you watch the evening news, you know, a lot of kids get their news from, I don't know, TikTok or, you know, from X, Twitter. They don't sit down at a set time every evening, you know, that old-fashioned ritual where they watch the news. But virtually every commercial is for this or that or the other drug. And it strikes me, Cheryl, and, you know, I've come up with kind of a theory that sometimes these drugs are extremely obscure drugs. For example, they'll advertise a drug like Keytruda, which is only suitable for certain types of lung cancer. So how is a person going to decide that they're going to opt for this drug? Now, the drugs are very expensive. There are drugs that are for very niche audience, for myasthenia gravis, for example, some, you know, monoclonal antibody for that, and how few people have that condition. I've heard it said that, in a sense, it doesn't matter what they're advertising. They're just paying big bucks to the networks as a form of kind of paying protection so that the news is slanted in favor of the pharmaceutical industry and against people who call it into question.
It would be pure conjecture on my part, but I think that's a very reasonable hypothesis based on what we know. And I've had the same thought when I've watched the ads for these seemingly obscure medicines that, you know, can't be that many people out there, you know, watching who it applies to. But beyond just what you see, let's look at how, gosh, when I went to the Kennedy Center Honors, which CBS sponsors or co-sponsors, so we get invited, you know, to go every year when I worked at CBS. And there's big Pfizer signs up there. I guess Pfizer co-sponsors it with the CBS. We're partners in that. If you watch 60 Minutes online, a replay, you're probably, at least last time I checked, you're going to get served Pfizer ads or drug company ads before they play the segment from 60 Minutes. I mean, it's endemic. It's really gotten to be everywhere. And the bonus for the pharmaceutical industry you know, I was there at a time when they had to reach down, or their interests reached into the newsroom and tried to stop stories. Now there's just a self-censoring. It's understood in America's newsrooms what the bosses do or don't want, what will or won't get on TV, what gets you accolades inside your newsroom versus what gets you frowned upon. I mean, one of the weirdest dynamics in my years at CBS, maybe the last 5 to 7 years, maybe I do some reporting that would receive international recognition, be picked up by other news outlets, maybe receive some awards that we covet inside the journalism industry. And yet I would be made kind of silently to feel like a dog. You know, certain managers wouldn't say a word. There was a time if you
were ostracized,
positive attention to the news division, yeah, you would feel, they would feel happy, but it kind of stopped. There would just be silence. I would walk in the newsroom the next day and nobody would look at me after, you know, big story that we broke. So you could tell something was going on, and people see the writing on the wall. They understand what's going to get them, you know, they're wasting their time if they work on uncovering stories about certain things, because somebody up the line is going to change the story or stop it, most likely.
I love the epigraph that you selected as a prelude to the book. It's near the frontispiece of the book, and it's a short quote: "No legitimate scientist ever declared science to be settled." And there's so much of this going on these days that we tend to say that there are certain immutable facts about science and medicine and health that conjure up the notion of misinformation, information that is incontrovertibly wrong because the authorities deny that possibility. So misinformation, a big theme these days, a lot of people are caught up in it, and your book addresses that squarely.
Well, you know, I hope people learn after they read the books or just do some of their own exploration that, and this is what happened to me, intuitively now, when I hear certain people or government authorities or the media in concert with one another declare that something is misinformation or not true or conjure a fact check about something, I assume that it's the opposite of what they say, that if they fact check something as false, that I should consider that it may very likely be true. And not only that, that they're very concerned, you know, some special powerful interest is behind the notion of wanting to discredit this idea that they perceive as particularly harmful. So my starting point now is, it took me a long time to get there, but this is just what happened with experience. My starting point is when I see the usual suspects / government / media all on the same page with their fact checks and so on. This doesn't happen organically. This happens as part of a concerted effort, and you should at least assume the possibility that the opposite of what they're saying is the case.
And COVID really provided kind of a teachable moment for the American public, because so many of the early pronouncements in COVID, such as, you know, overestimates of the toll that it was going to take, issues around masking, issues around natural immunity, those plexiglass barriers that we futilely put up everywhere, the 6-foot distancing, and also vaccine efficacy. The vaccine was going to stop the spread. Then they conceded that maybe it's not going to stop the spread, but, you know, we're going to save lives. But ultimately, that the vaccine had virtually no side effects. The side effects were extremely rare and not that serious. And then it emerged on all these fronts that the powers that be were feeding us lying.
Well, it's still the case. So I think one of the biggest lapses in this post-COVID time period is that there's still confusion. Maybe not among people like us, but I think the general public that doesn't have time to research for itself and may have limited resources that they turn to get their information. Nobody's been held accountable for the intentional disinformation put out by the government. And I say disinformation, not just misinformation. This was stuff that we could prove they knew was wrong at the time they said it and continued to disseminate it. There has been no reform of our public health agencies after it's been acknowledged widely, even by CDC, that they failed at their most important task handling this pandemic. And I interviewed one of CDC's most ardent supporters who said that agency has to be rebuilt from top to bottom. And Congress, the Republicans in Congress, when they gained their slight majority just ahead of that, promised to force something like that, and nothing's happened. In fact, CDC has had no reforms. They've gotten budget increases, as well as FDA has, even though they had, you know, advisors quit over some of the decisions being made during COVID and since then that were so outrageous, were considered to be outrageous from a medical standpoint. Nothing's changed. And now they're trying to convince us we may have a bird flu pandemic, and maybe we will, maybe we won't. But the public trust isn't there. There's going to be so much confusion if they try to, you know, direct yet another pandemic without having fixed the problems they created with the last one.
Let's switch gears a little bit and address something that you talk about in the book, which is big food and its efforts to influence dietary policy and health policy in this country. And there's an interesting article, and you probably saw it, I'm pretty sure, across your radar screen in the Washington Post. Headline, "As Obesity Rises, Big Food and Dietitians Push Anti-Diet Advice." Now, there's this thing called the fat acceptance movement, which is to the good, because kind of the last bastion of prejudice in America is against fat people. You know, you can't be Islamophobic, you can't be anti-Semitic, you can't be racist, you can't be transphobic or homophobic, but it's okay to make jokes and disparage fat people, so I get it. Fat acceptance movement, there's something to be said for it. But big food is kind of latching onto that to push what is called anti-diet advice. Influencers are out there advocating something called health at every size, which, by the way, is HAES, is trademarked and is kind of a slogan of the fat acceptance movement. So what's going on out there? They're literally people who are on the payroll who are trying to shape policy and make people feel it's acceptable to eat junk food.
Well, pretty much, I hate to say this, but every organized movement where you're going to see publicity about and people trying to pass laws and policies is brought about by some vested money interest. And I assume this is no different. I think from a broader standpoint, I've seen evidence that a lot of the health maladies that we're suffering today and trends, whether it's the transgender trends with boys feeling like girls and girls feeling like boys, a lot of this stuff can be potentially pointed. We could point to things like the toxins and poisons and chemicals in our water and food that interrupt our endocrine system and kick off the hormones in a weird direction and damage our systems, and can cause you, for example, the result of this can be insulin issues that can cause obesity, not just that you're eating more food, but what's in the food that we're eating today. But all of this can be distracted by the notion that you can't criticize it or even look into the causes of it, because that would be insulting. That would be saying that you don't like fat people. I think with the transgender trends, it's the same thing. We need to be asking if this is a real trend and not just there may be some jumping on the bandwagon because people hear about, you know, the transgender movement or whatever you want to say. So maybe that's created the appearance of an uptick. But to the extent there is an uptick, and I believe there is, in boys feeling like girls and girls feeling like boys, well, to force America to just say that's a good thing, we should all be happy about it, versus saying, but let's also see what could be causing it, like the professor from Berkeley who discovered many years ago that atrazine, a chemical commonly found in our drinking water today, caused boy frogs to, you know, lose their masculinity, shall we say, and they've turned into girl frogs. And a body of research in the time since he did that original research has said that it affects virtually every animal and mammal in amounts lower than what the government allows. So we should be looking, and that's one chemical of thousands that we're exposing ourselves to. So I'm sorry for the long answer, but I just think you're right. By these movements that require us to accept things that were not considered common or normal too long ago, I think are trying to get us distracted from looking at the causes, the root causes, which could implicate these large industries.
Yeah, let's take a look at recommendations about food, because we have this thing called the DGA, the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, which is said to provide, quote, science-based advice on dietary intake to promote health, reduce risk of chronic disease, and to meet our nutrient needs. And it's public policy about what we should eat. And it's hopelessly mired in obsolete notions about nutrition, encouraging people to continue to eat a lot of carbohydrates and, you know, have a, quote, balanced intake of the macronutrients, which tends to make Americans obese, insulin resistant, and diabetic. And there's just an article that caught my attention today, and it's on the theme of misinformation. And it's an article by one of the authors of the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, who says, unfortunately, misinformation about the scientific basis, transparency, and relevance of the Dietary Guidelines for the U.S. population threatens its credibility. The main objective of this article is to correct this misinformation with factual information. So, again, that word keeps popping up. Misinformation means maybe information that's hostile to the powers that be.
I think more often than not, that is what it means, particularly if you can identify the same sources, whether it's PolitiFact, Poynter Institute, factcheck.org, I believe it is. Like, there's these giant organizations that were either... Wikipedia, absolutely. Giant organizations that were either started for the purpose during this time period, which I've traced in my books, to try to control this information under the guise of so-called fact checks and so on, or organizations that pre-existed that have been co-opted by the big money, the money interests that now contribute to them so that they can control the content. Now, I did an investigation for Real Clear Investigations that traced the big money behind a lot of these interests. And in every instance, these fact checkers say, our big donors don't influence our editorial posse. But what are the odds, the natural odds, that every fact check they do comes down on one side all the time in a sort of a homogeneous way that never gives any due to potential questions on the other side? And then I'll just tell you from a factual standpoint, I constantly am reading these, and they're filled with facts, you know, incorrect, not just even misinformation, but just with fact errors. I think it's called healthfeedback.com, which Facebook relies upon, just conjured up a 5-year-old story I did, which they said went viral, and fake fact checked it by, basically, this is one strategy they do. They fact check a claim that was never made and then say the claim that was never actually made, they reword it a way that they can say was misleading. And then they start spewing out a bunch of facts and information. And in this case, virtually nothing they said was true. Like, either it wasn't in the report that I made, or what was in my report was accurate and fair, but they mischaracterized it or gave their opinion as to why something might not be the case and then called that the truth, you know, just something that was conjecture on their part. This was a story I've done about the top expert witness for the government, which defends vaccine injuries in court, Dr. Andrew Zimmerman, who is a big vaccine proponent. He always had said vaccines don't cause autism, but there came a time some years ago when he changed his mind and actually treated patients that he said the vaccines had caused their autism. He said this happens in rare cases, and he gave their explanation for how it happens. And he, years later, in an affidavit that I reported on in this story, swore that when he informed the Department of Justice of this fact during a trial, during some of these cases about autism and vaccines, and said, hey, my opinion has changed. Vaccines can cause autism after all, and here's how. So please don't misrepresent my opinion in court. The government fired him as an expert witness and then went on to misrepresent his opinion the following week, you know, without his presence, saying that he still felt the way that he had felt previously. Anyway, long story short, that was just a factual story that recounted this information. And somebody's apparently worried about it 5 years later because they, again, conjured a fake fact check about it just the other day. And this is just the type of things that they do.
Well, I think a major reason for your virtual cancellation by mainstream media is because you kind of touched the third rail. You wrote stories that questioned the efficacy and safety of vaccines, and you highlighted the vaccine autism connection. And that's just a place where you can't go in American public discourse without being banned, shadow banned, canceled, and virtually exiled.
Well, it's the most successful propaganda campaign of our time, or at least among the most successful campaigns, because in the early 2000s, it wasn't like that. But the industry saw this giant group of cases coming with the autism spike that was likely, in my view, based on the science related to the vaccination policies in this country. And they carefully crafted a whole strategy to make it where you can't even ask the rational scientific questions. And many scientists did, and reporters were, and scientists still do, including, for example, Dr. Bernadine Healy, who was at one time head of the National Institutes of Health. Mm-hmm. Very credible scientists were looking into this and saying, wow, this is something that must be addressed. But the propaganda campaign that permeated government and media made it where, as you say, illogically, it's the one thing we're not allowed to, the product that almost every American gets more than once, we're not allowed to ask safety questions about, even when research and studies bring them up. And I just, you know, I knew nothing about vaccines. My daughter's fully vaccinated. I've been over vaccinated because I've been revaccinated for things I was already vaccinated for when I travel with the military to embed as a member of the media. Knew nothing about this. But as I discovered that peer-reviewed published studies existed saying the very thing that you hear can't be true, of course, that made me curious. And when I began speaking with insiders and industry and government that, you know, showed more evidence of cover-ups and scientific evidence that this link exists, you know, it would be irresponsible for me to pretend the truth is the opposite of what I know it to be in terms of what evidence is out there.
It sounds like your guiding principle is that you're an investigative journalist and you're going to go down those rabbit holes, even if it's going to cause you some professional, shall we say, hurdles, roadblocks, or even opprobrium.
Well, it's a super interesting area of investigation, first of all. And second of all, I didn't know right away what kind of trouble this would cause for people who honestly and factually reported this topic, because at first it wasn't like that. And as it came to be the subject of so much pushback from special interests, I started to feel it but not understand it. And yes, I guess stubbornly just continue to report as I did any story. I refused to change tacks or viewpoints on what could be one of the more important stories of our time simply because the powerful interests implicated don't want the stories done. To me, that makes it even more important to try to get the information out so that people have full information at their fingertips if they're doing research.
Okay, good point at which to pause, because we kind of laid down our groundwork for our discussion in part two. We're going to talk more about the effort to shape our health policies, to shape the science that underlies our medical treatments and our medications. Our intrepid investigative journalist is Cheryl Atkisson. She has just written a book entitled Follow the Science, which will be out September 3rd and is available anywhere for pre-order. And so when we return, more on the subject of her book, Follow the Science, and some fascinating revelations that she's made in the book that I think are very relevant for us to hear about. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.